Hello and welcome everyone to Masterclass this Thursday night, June 29th, 2023. I'm looking forward to this one. We've got four presenters this evening. Looking forward to what they have to say. There's a variety of topics, which is going to be really cool. And we should have some fun. So we can get started with, let's see, go over here. Find my list. Mark, are you ready?
Yeah.
All right.
Let me share my screen and make sure I got it set up correctly. Beginning. Okay, so my presentation is on hearing aids.
So we see your presenter page and not the full page.
Oh, oops.
That's okay. It happens. Go down to the bottom and you click the book.
Why did it do that? Stop sharing. Let me share that out. So, there we go. Is that better?
That's it.
Okay, so my presentation is on hearing aids. So dating back as far as the 13th century, people have been trying to help with hearing loss. The first device used to help with hearing loss was hollowed out animal horns, such as cow horns. They didn't really work that well because they didn't amplify the sound. And it wasn't until the 18th century that the more sophisticated ear trumpet was invented. The ear trumpet is basically a hollowed out horn with some fittings on it to make it a bit more comfortable. And the metal rim, I would assume, helps with sound quality. The stethoscope is another invention that helps with hearing. Although it's not necessarily used to help with hearing loss, Dr. René Laennec invented the stethoscope in 1860 by rolling up a paper tube and using it as a funnel to hear his patient's breathing. Realizing this amplified the sounds coming from the chest, he named it the stethoscope, which originated from the Greek words stethos, which means chest, and scopion, which means to view or see. After the hearing trumpet gained popularity, some other inventions were made to help with hearing loss. During a time way before cell phones or other electronics could be used to send a text message to get someone's attention, the speaking tube was invented. The speaking tube was the first form of an intercom. One end was used to speak into, while the other was a tube that came out of the wall, and it was flared at the end, usually consisting of metal that helped to amplify the sound. These were popular in Victorian times when it was considered inappropriate to shout or call for someone from another room. The discovery of electricity in the 1700s brought tons of innovations. This, of course, included hearing devices. One of the most popular inventions of all time is the telephone. It was invented by Alexander Graham Bell in 1875. And soon people started to realize that they could hear better using a telephone rather than having an in-person conversation. Being very intrigued by electricity and the inventions being created with it, Thomas Edison was determined to improve upon them. Saying Thomas Edison helped improve the telephone is a huge understatement. He invented the carbon transmitter in 1870, which increased the electrical signal and raised the volume by 15 decibels. This didn't just improve the telephone. It swung the doors wide open for future technological advancements. From 1902 to around 1921, the carbon hearing aid worked as an improvement, but was not the best because it delivered a scratchy noise. The vacuum tube brought even more improvement to the hearing aids, as well as many other technological advancements. The vacuum tube was incorporated into hearing aids in 1921, which had better control on the flow of electricity and increased the volume by 70 decibels. The major downside to vacuum tubes was that they were the size of a filing cabinet, which certainly didn't help with portability or being discreet. Although still bulky, the vacuum tubes were made into a portable size in a box, and a receiver came out one end that the user could hold up to their ear. The next breakthrough was yet another major milestone in technology. Bell Laboratories invented the transistor in 1948. The transistor can start and stop the flow of electricity. It can also control the volume on hearing devices to allow different settings. Norman Krim, the inventor of the vacuum tube, saw even more potential in the transistor, which led to him inventing the junction transistor. This invention made it possible to make hearing aids even smaller, and eventually the first wearable behind-the-ear hearing aid was invented. I'm going to jump forward a little bit now and talk a little bit more about modern technology. This is the Starkey Liveo Edge AI hearing aid. It integrated artificial intelligence and increased the performance of hearing aids. These hearing aids bring sound quality that was never possible before, and can perform in the most challenging listening environments. Bluetooth technology has been around for a while, and it has also helped improve functionality in hearing aids. The Starkey hearing aids are made for iPhone hearing aids. This can be confusing because you would think, well, it uses Bluetooth, so why doesn't it just connect to everything? Well, devices like smartphones have an HAC reading that was regulated by the FCC, which means hearing aid compatibility. Smartphones usually have a reading of M3 and M4, or T3 and T4. The M rating is for acoustic coupling, and the T rating is for inductive coupling. As of right now, the rating for Android devices is M3 T3. And the rating for iPhone devices is M3 T4. This means iPhones have a higher standard for hearing aid compatibility, and a higher standard for Bluetooth connectivity, which is less likely to have any interference. If you aren't an iPhone user, no worries. There are additional devices that allow other devices, such as Android devices, to connect with hearing aids, but still the connection won't be as great. Most hearing aids come in multiple styles to offer users choices that will fit their lifestyles and personal preference. Behind the ear hearing aids are the most common style. This style is easy to hold and adjust. The larger style allows for a larger battery and a longer battery life. The receiver in the canal style is similar to behind the ear, but more compact, which gives the user more discretion when wearing the hearing aids. The size also provides more durability and features. In-the-ear style hearing aids provide a custom fit in the user's ear canal. The hearing aid does block up the entire ear canal, which provides pros and cons. A pro is that it helps block out background noises. A con is that it blocks up the entire canal and it can become irritating. Similar to in-the-ear canal, similar to the in-the-ear, the in-the-canal is a bit smaller, making it less visible than the larger style. The completely in-the-canal style is a custom fit that has the entire hearing aid in the ear canal with only the small handle used to remove it showing. Something to consider with the smaller styles is some features might be restricted because of the small size, and they require a smaller battery and more frequent charging. The most discreet style available for this hearing aid is the invisible in the canal style. It rests even further in the ear canal, making it very difficult to notice. The smaller sizes can have difficulties for people with dexterity issues. And although they are discreet, it comes at the price of missing out on some functionality. Many hearing aids have rechargeable batteries, which is a huge relief for users, especially someone who has issues handling the small coin-like batteries used in other hearing aids. It is also a huge step from having to carry around an electrical box to provide power. Recharging the hearing aids is just like recharging earbuds. The charge box is charged using a micro USB cord. The four small lights on the back indicate the level of charge the box holds. When the box is fully charged, it can fully recharge the hearing aids three times. To fully recharge the hearing aids, it takes about 1 hour. If you're in a rush, the box is not only portable, but can give the hearing aids 3 hours of use on a 15-minute charge. The two lights on the front of the box will blink green while the hearing aids are charging and hold a solid green when they are fully charged. If there are any connection issues, the light will turn red. The hearing aids have metal pins that will connect magnetically to the pedestals in the charge box, making it really easy to charge them. Starkey has the Thrive app that can be used on smart devices that connects to the hearing aids and is used to help control them. The app works sort of like a remote and helps to change the settings of the hearing aids. The main page of the app shows a few things and allows the user to navigate to other pages to change features. The user can control the volume of the hearing aids. The icon at the top right will show the battery levels of the hearing aids. The question icon allows the user to ask questions by speaking into the phone, and the user will get a response that is streamed through the hearing aids. The round kind of pie chart shows a wellness score, which I'll discuss on another slide, along with the other features like the different settings that are shown on the blue bar. The overall wellness score consists of two things, activity and engagement. They are tracked by the power of the artificial intelligence used in the hearing aids. Activity is measured by the user's physical activity throughout the day, much like health trackers in smartphones. It tracks steps, exercise, and time spent standing. The engagement tracks different sounds, such as different environments and conversations. All of this activity is important because they are needed to have a healthy brain. The memory settings can be found using the blue bar found on the main page. The different memory settings have presets and can be used for different environments to block out different unwanted noises. The user can also change the settings manually to block out background noise that suits their personal preference. The artificial intelligence can differentiate between different types of background noise, such as mechanical noises, wind, and speech. The AI will also track the user's geolocation and automatically change to that setting when the user is in that location again. One of the best settings with these specific hearing aids is mask mode. In the height of the COVID pandemic, face coverings and masks were mandated to go almost anywhere. This was a serious issue for people with hearing loss, as many of them depended on lip reading to depict what someone was saying. Mask mode was made to help enhance the sound of the speech that is muffled by masks. There are several other features built into the Thrive app. The self-check feature can be used to check the components of the hearing aid and will let the user know if something isn't working as well as the severity of the malfunction. The components to check are the microphone, the receiver, and the circuit. A con to the custom sizes are they often will have to be sent to the manufacturer for repair, while styles like behind-the-ear hearing aids can be fixed by the audiologist right there in the office. The hearing aids are also able to detect falls. This feature works just like Life Alert, but the Thrive app will contact an emergency contact that is listed on the smartphone. The feature that I consider the best is the translate and transcribe features. The user can set the languages being used in the conversation, and the conversation will be translated and streamed to the hearing aids. The artificial intelligence can recognize over 25 languages and even the transcribe feature is similar, but instead of streaming the conversation, it will transcribe the conversation into text on the phone. And I lost it. And there's a lot of other things that I have not covered, and there's a ton of information that you can found can that you can find online. So that's my presentation.
Excellent job. Excellent. You know, it's
Great.
this is not something that you would normally think about, right? But look how IT has grown so much to be able to help those with, hearing disabilities. That's just awesome to see. That's
Yeah.
very cool.
It just came at too late for my husband because his doctor said nothing can be done.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, at that point anyway. Yeah,
Yeah.
so but we knew sign I know sign language, so we communicated with
That
sign
helped.
language.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely helped a lot.
Well, that was very good, Mark. That was
Yeah, that
excellent.
was nice. I liked it.
We came a long way from sticking animal horns in our ears.
Yes. And we don't have to walk around
Definitely.
looking funny, right?
That's
Who
interesting,
knows?
though.
Maybe it'll come back like bell bottoms did. You never know.
I wonder, is it the length of the horn crucial to hearing the sounds? I wonder if that made a difference in that using the horn. I mean, I'm just a curiosity anyway.
Right.
I don't have any horns to try it out, but
Right. We don't.
I was kind of curious if the length of it changed, if it was longer for those who cannot hear, was it to, could they hear better? Or did they have it shorter because of they, anyway.
Only need a little bit. Right. I mean, you never know, right? It might have
Yeah.
been something like that.
I don't know. I just think about the can. You know how we used to do that can
Yes.
thing, and try to talk to people with the can. So,
Yeah, right.
yeah, I'm from the old school.
Yeah, no, me too. I remember it. I remember it. That's right.
Yeah, I think the longer the tube, the lower the harmonic is going to be, so it might make it worse.
Yeah,
Oh, interesting.
true.
I didn't think about that.
Yeah, I think probably the material composition is going to be the better aspect to optimize if you're
Yeah,
going with
exactly.
go primitive horn status.
Huh. That would have
Right.
been interesting
Yeah.
to see, yeah, how it
Depends on the
worked.
horn, right?
Yeah. Or do you have a one of those elk horn, like the sheep?
You might not want one that actually has a curve to it. You want more of a, like a straight horn or
More
something.
straight.
Yeah. That's funny.
I'm just waiting to hear somebody hack one of these now.
Right,
I know. Could you
exactly.
use a tusk? An elephant tusk?
If you drilled it empty, probably.
I think it's hollow. But we can't experiment because it's illegal to have
Yeah, it's
ivory
illegal. Right,
tusk.
exactly. Yeah.
Bummer.
So
Yeah.
anyway, that was excellent, Mark. That was a great idea to come up with something like that to present. So I really enjoyed that one.
Thank you. Yeah, my entire time, I have not heard hearing devices mentioned.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah. So things change. Everything changes. So we got to assume that's going to change too.
there is a newer hearing aid that I just found out about when I was doing research for this by the same company that the artificial intelligence can now imitate the cerebral cortex.
Oh.
Yep, that's what
Man.
we need now. More capacity.
Yes, I agree. More
Yeah.
capacity.
Goodness. Right. Let's go on to Nathan. Are you ready?
Yep, I'm all ready. I don't see the option to, oh, there it is. All right, can you see my main screen there?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Cool. All right. I went with the evolution of storage media in gaming, as you can tell. Just trying to cover the evolution from cartridges up to what we have today as direct downloads, where we just download across the internet. There we go. So I started off with cartridges here. This is from the Fairchild Channel F. It's the oldest thing I could find. That's not the oldest game I could find. I don't know what year that one's from, but I decided to stick a cartridge up there just so it wouldn't be just a console up on the screen. So while I do like the signature clack of inserting a cartridge, I still prefer just gaming today, where we just download whatever we want, or we buy a physical key that just has a code on it. You put it into your system and then it gives you the game. Cartridges were popular back in the day because they had fast read and write speeds for their time. Obviously things have sped up since then, but the downside was that every console had its own cartridges and you couldn't play all of the games on one console. So while gamers had to make a decision with that, they also had to decide which console had the best selection of games they could play and what they could do with their time, and if they could play with friends as well, because some consoles only were single player. Today we still see the use of cartridges with the Nintendo systems. The Nintendo DS, which just recently got phased out entirely, has been replaced with the Nintendo Switch, which uses what looks to be an SD card, but it's still a cartridge because it's not an SD card. All right. Next was the data set for the Commodore 64, or the Commodore, because there were multiple versions. It wasn't explicitly just the 64. So the data set was the next set of media to be released that was used in gaming. It was popular in the 70s and the 80s, as the Commodore 64 was a popular device to have. And the data set had limited popularity because it only ran on the Commodore. There wasn't any other systems that used it. Also, the data set, as you can see, is just like a cassette tape. It's not really a fancy type of material, so you didn't have disc technology at the time, just barely. But they were limited, as they could only be used either one side or the other, or both sides. And that was only about 150 kilobytes of data on each side of the cassette, so not much to work with. And they'd obviously burn out over time, but I'm sure, I don't know if anybody here has ever burned out a cassette tape, but it does happen. Next is the LaserDisc, and I found the oldest game I could find, which I guess you could call it a game, is Quarter Horse, which was just a video recording of several horse races, and you would gamble on which horse you thought was going to win each race. You could find them in arcades and in bars, I believe, at the time. This game in the late 70s, as you can see. I'm just trying to catch up on my notes. It was popular at the time because it had audio and video storage for developers. But this is much bigger than a CD or DVD or Blu-ray, which I'll be covering later. And as it was bigger, it was also more prone to damage, as bending a CD is basically ending it, and getting scratches on it also obviously damages the disc. So the LaserDisc could also hold up to one hour of media at a time. So it wasn't so much a storage-based idea. It was more of a storage-based issue. It was more of a, it's hard to put it into words. It's holding 1 hour of video, so it wasn't like you were playing an actual game on the disc. It wasn't like it was reading the disc in different places at different times to project something on the screen. It was reading it as if it were just a video. Now I move on to the floppy disk, which I thought was going to be the first one in the list, but the oldest I could find was a 1983 game called Bushido, which you'd play on your PC or I forget what the other device was. Mostly PCs, but there were some other devices that could play with floppy disks. They were popular for a time just due to their wide use in computers, but you could know another game called Doom that came out in 93, I believe. And that was a graphic game that pushed for the development of time towards determining ratings for video games, because there was ratings for movies, but at the time, video games could be whatever you wanted, and there was no restrictions. Floppy disks were preferred over the other sources of media, the 3.5-inch one at least, because it was more dense, it was harder to break than the other ones, and it also lasted longer than, say, your data set or your laser disc in some cases. But nowadays, you just find them and you can use them as a coaster on your coffee table. This particular model could have held up to 1 megabyte, but as time went on, there were more floppy disks of the same size that could hold up to, I think, 6 megabytes at the maximum. There we go. And now I move on to compact disks, which the oldest game I could find was Need for Speed. Well, not the oldest game. The oldest game I could find was Need for Speed on the 3DO, which was a compact disc player. It looks like a little DVD player, but, you know, those were the days when things could just be simple. Compact discs were my main gaming adventure began with the Sega Dreamcast, which I should have pictured here, but I didn't. The CD allowed for more storage space and allowing bigger and better games to be developed. This was also offered with a smaller bit of media, not so much smaller than the DVD or the floppy disk, but smaller than the compact, or not the compact, the laser disk. Gosh. So it was roughly half the size, or one quarter the size of a laser disk. So it was much easier to store and less likely to be damaged. So another device that used the CD later on was the PlayStation 1. You may have known that, or you may know its successor, the PlayStation 2, which used DVDs. We'll get to that next. The bonus to a compact disc was that it could hold 700 megabytes of data, or maybe bytes of data, not megabytes. They used a different term back then, and it means a slightly different thing, a slightly different amount of data. It's, I can't remember, it's like to the second power, it's to the 20th power or to the second power of data. It's slightly more than 700 megabytes, just to put it simply. So we've got DVDs next, and with the launch of the PS2 and the Xbox, the CD had been phased out to permit the use of DVDs. Like with the developments in the past, this gave even more space for developers to work with and produce higher quality content. DVDs also had a higher rotational speed than CDs, which allowed for faster data transfer between the device and the disc. I've selected the PS2 here to show as I've selected the PS2 here as it's the most popular selling console of all time. The Nintendo Switch is catching up, I believe, but it's up there with like 150 million or more than that, I think. I didn't write the number down because I'm an idiot, but it's up there. You can find it on Wikipedia, I'm sure. It's one Google search away. At the dawn of the DVD, it was only ever up to 4.7 gigabytes. And I'm using the dawn here because this is the year 2000 is what I've marked up there. As time went on, they held more and more data as they were not double-sided, but they had double-layered, so you could have extra data in there. Now we've reached one that's easily overlooked. It's the mini DVD. it was adopted by Nintendo because they didn't want to pay full-size DVD licensing. And it was a good idea in the short term because it limited piracy at the time, as it was harder to read a mini DVD on a regular DVD player. But it never really took off in popularity because it had reduced storage size when compared to the DVD player or compared to the DVD. The single-layered models held up to 1.46 gigabytes, so that's drastically less. It was 4.7 on a regular DVD. And then this is one of the only two pieces of gaming media that I've never held. I've never used a data set before, or the UMD, which is the Universal Media Disc. And while this media makes use of the word universal, it was primarily used by its developer, Sony. There was not much else that ever made use of it at the time. It was made to fit their standard handheld device, the PSP. The UMD could hold up to 900 megabytes of data on a single layer, and if it was double layer, it could hold 1.8 gigabytes. So as with all of these, I'm sorry if I didn't show. I've been waving my mouse on the wrong screen this whole time. But I related these to the release of the media and then the game that came out the closest to that release date. I apologize for not making that clear sooner. And I've been waving my mouse, like I said, on the wrong screen. Next came the Blu-ray player, which was a debacle for a lot of people because if you had a European disc, you couldn't play it on an American DVD player or Blu-ray player. And it was just a struggle for a lot of people. But the PlayStation 3 was the first to use a Blu-ray player. It came in a year after the Xbox 360, and that's when the Blu-ray was invented or developed, so they made use of it that way. It allowed for higher resolution textures and more storage space on each disc. As I said, the Xbox was a year earlier, and it made use of HD DVDs instead of just regular DVDs. A Blu-ray single layer, as was in this initial time, could hold 25 gigabytes of data on a single layer. And if it was a dual layer, it could hold up to 66 gigabytes. But it's not likely that there was a dual layer Blu-ray on the initial launch of the Blu-ray. So that's, I'm going to stick with the 25 gigabyte number. But I'd like to include that Blu-rays actually have a potential of four layers instead of just two like a normal DVD. This allows up to 128 gigabytes of storage. But I doubt that ever reached this era of console. And now we're moving on to today, which has streaming and direct downloads. For a long time, consoles and PCs have had internal storage that allowed you to download games and sometimes keep them digitally. Sorry, give me a second. I have to cough. Okay. Allowing for digital downloads on these devices meant that gamers didn't need a physical copy to keep track of, which over time, physical Blu-rays for consoles turned into product keys rather than actual games, so you would still download it directly from the internet to your console. There's also cases where you could buy a card or like it looks like a gift card, and then you peel off the back and there would be your key code to get the game on your console. However, after using this, it would be locked to your account, so only you could play it unless you signed in on someone else's account and downloaded the game again. Whereas with CDs and DVDs and Blu-rays in the past, you could just put it into a console and then you'd have the game. So storage in this case would be on an SSD or a standard disk drive instead of like on the physical media. And then I included streaming here because while it's not a physical media, it's the latest type of development. It's trying to be pushed out towards gamers. So streaming had a rocky start, as it required a fast internet connection and uninterrupted internet. So if you had any type of issues, if your internet was slow, if you had spotty connections due to clouds with a satellite dish or something like that, you would lose connection and the game would disconnect. And you'd have to reconnect to the game, hoping that your status was saved and that you could continue where you started off. But what this did allow is for gamers to play without having storage media at their house. So you could play on your phone, let's say, and without downloading the game to your phone, you could still play the game, regardless of its size, as if you were playing it right there and then. I'm going to include something here. The Google Stadia, if you've heard of that, was a gaming streaming service that went up and went down in roughly 3 to 5 years, I believe. Just there weren't enough people that bought into it because they didn't see the simplicity of it and the safety, I guess, of it. Because what ended up happening was the company decided, oh, it's not profitable. And so they cut the service. And so every game that anyone had bought on Google Stadia was now gone. They didn't have physical media that they could fall back on. They just lost access to all those games that they had bought. So now I have question time, if anyone has any. All right, then. It's my sources.
Well, that was really good. You brought me back. That's way, way back. That's for sure. My uncle had the Commodore with the tapes. That was the first time I had seen that.
Yep. My dad still has a Laserdisc. I don't remember what's on it, but I've held that before. And then the data set I've never seen, or in person at least.
Yeah. It's crazy what we've been through. To now, we don't even have to hold anything. You just download it. I hate it because I'm like, you know, I'm old school. It's like, no, the kids want to get these Steam games. And I'm like, aren't you worried you're going to lose the Steam game? And they're like, no, I can change it out and download it every time I need it. And I'm thinking, man.
Yeah, because it's in the cloud.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, I have the disc. Sorry. I need the disc. Yep. It's nothing's tangible anymore, you know?
They won't give you this.
I know.
I don't know how you can get one.
It's just like money. Nothing's tangible. It's like money goes. Like, that's it. It's hard. I'm just old school.
The real question is what's going to be next? Because
yeah, right?
Virtual reality, you know, games are going to get more and more memory needing, and download times are always tough.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
Quantum crystals.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, sounds good. Sounds good.
Right. This is great because it's a good conversation piece. I mean, sheesh. Wow. Yeah.
It brought a lot of memories back to me.
Yeah, a cloud service.
Hearing all this.
It could be something like if you're not going to get something that has to be downloaded, you actually go on there and you play it. So now we're getting into those games that we can already play. Like, I think the last one I played online was D&D. You play WoW, you play, you know, and all those. You go online and you play them and it saves it. And is that what it's going to come to? That everything's going to be online?
Remember the cassettes. You used to have to save your programs on them.
Mm-hmm, I know.
And then you accidentally put it in your cassette player and you listen to it. It's not the same thing.
No, my uncle was telling me about that. You can mess them up. Mm-hmm. I'm like, how do you do that? And he's like, well, just like you would, you know, record a song or something. You just record it on there. I'm like, wow.
You could also break it. Yeah.
You could also break it, yeah.
Break the tapes. That was bad. Then you try to figure out how can you splice it back.
Yeah, right.
They used to sell kits to do that.
Yeah, I know.
That's right.
I know. But
there's only so many generations remember what a pen is used for, right?
Yeah.
For cassette tape.
But you can also use a pen on Apple, the iPad on tablets.
Oh, yeah, right. the pin, for the pinholes. Yep.
So it
yep.
depends on which pen you're talking about.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. The real That's true. The pen. I'm talking pen? Like a Bic
paper.
Pen.
Paper.
You know, no, ink pen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No such thing.
When you had to wind your cassette tape back up, you know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, to find the right program that you saved.
Yeah. Ooh, exactly. That'd be hard.
Oh,
well,
my gosh.
You had to make sure you wrote down where it was on the tape from the counter.
Mm-hmm. True.
Yep.
Like, man, might not ever find it.
Boy, life was so much more difficult back then, wasn't it?
Well, we had a lot more challenges in those
We did, because we didn't know better. So
I did
that
some
was
creative things. Yeah, yeah, I did some creative things with my things. But
yeah, we got excited for 4KB.
Exactly. I know, it's terrible.
Ooh, I got a 5 gig hard drive. Isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I loved it.
Well, back well, then, at least you actually got to own the medium. Like, currently, like, I think HBO is doing it, but they're just deleting shows, and now there's no way to see them anymore. And if that's how games go, like, if you need to re-download or someone, or they're just like, it's gone. Even Amazon, when you buy, in quotation, movies from them online, there's a thing saying if they lose the licensing, you're just out that money and can no longer watch the medium.
Yeah, see, and that's just wrong.
Oh, that's not fair.
It's not, but like you agree to it in the terms of service. It's just like those 300
but who reads
pages.
The terms of service?
But they don't read
who
it.
Who reads that?
No one. And it's also been proven in court that you cannot hold up terms and services if people violate them because if they're after a certain length. And so,
yeah.
Right. It's one of those things where they'll get sneaky with it and you basically lose everything if they decide they don't want to give it anymore. So that's what I think it will happen to games once they go digital. It'd be like, oh, sorry, you bought this game for $100. We just don't have it anymore.
Yeah,
you're just out that money. We're not refunding or giving you a different game for the same price. It's just gone.
Terrible.
Bummer.
Mm-hmm. That's why I prefer
the game you like. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's why I prefer buying discs and everything.
Yeah.
It's like, no, I want
even
it.
Movies. You know, if you find a movie that you really, really love, just buy the movie. Because you know you're gonna be sitting on that Blu-ray player that you have forever anyway. So just like if you still have a VHS player. I wish I still had my VHS players and tape decks, you know? I have a record player. I do have one. I wish I had my old one because this one's a cheap one. But, you know, we always tend to go back, right? It always comes around. Mm-hmm. If you live long enough, it'll come around.
Yeah. Well, record players are actually back in.
I know. They have records.
All that analog technology.
I know. They have records at Walmart. I love it.
If you have a VHS player, be careful. Those use magnets, and those magnets do lose their magnetism over time. I've had several that I've had to replace the magnets on.
Really? I didn't know that.
I didn't know either. Yeah.
Well, your topic was wonderful because it started off in so many conversations. What a great job. That was really good.
I enjoyed it.
Yes.
Thank you.
It was great. All right. Let's do Alec Kramer. Alec, are you there? Yes.
Yes, I apologize.
No problem.
I had to give up. I have a class at 10. I forgot. So let me just make this kind of quick. But
do you want to reschedule?
No, I just told him I'll be a little late. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. I'd rather get this out of the way.
Okay.
Can you see my screen?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So, as Nathan did video games, he covered the storage in video games. I also covered something in video games, but rather I'm doing pseudocode in video games. And while I'm not too familiar with coding, I would like to be in the future, so I'm going to cover pseudocode because I know more about that. So for a little definition of pseudocode, what pseudocode is. Pseudocode represents coding without the needing of a programming language. This gives developers a better understanding before using a language such as C#, Java, or Python. This can be used in app development, data science, and web development. All of developers start working out a process before beginning code. So Ruby, C#, they both are like commands that are used in languages. So those are some things that they have to use with pseudocode. It's an easy understanding for those with basic programming skills. So it's a starting point for a lot of individuals. I use this as well when building switches or case statements, which I'll discuss here in a second. And then pseudocode helps, it translates code into syntax. And what syntax is, which I didn't know, was they're just rules for defining a language. So as naming conversations, class names, files names, every language has their own like rules for code before you begin programming. So for the first type of pseudocode is switches. I use this to, or tasks are performed in a linear manner. Events take place as specific actions occur, or a character is in a desired location. So once a character reaches a location or completes a task, the next prompt will be shown. Switches turn on or off based on the events. So examples of this include Gears of War. So this one, like in Gears of War, when you reach a certain checkpoint or reach a certain checkpoint, a prompt will be shown to tell you what's going to happen next. So it's kind of a linear type scenario where one thing happens, then this will happen. Pokemon's probably the best example because you can't progress through the game without completing something else first. So you have to do one thing before you do the next thing. In Mario, for example, I don't know if anyone, I mean, I'm sure everyone's played Mario maybe a little bit. But like once you reach the flagpole, then you can go to the next level or open the next level. You can't just go straight to the do any level you want. You have to do it from one thing to the next. And then quick time sequences, these are actions that appear when the player must perform a movement. So like in Bayonetta, Tomb Raider, Resident Evil, all these games have like a tutorial type sequence to where when you start the game, it'll say press A to jump or something or press X to fly. These are quick time. They tell you to do it right away. And then after that, it'll prompt you to do another thing. Loops in pseudocode. So these are instructions that happen continuously until a condition is met. These events occur over and over. So games will repeat dialogue or a function until the process is disposed of through a break loop. These loops are for loops, while loops, nested loops. For loops are just loops that keep repeating over and over. Those are the most basic example. While loops are like a conditional type scenario. So where while one thing is occurring, something else will loop and the loop won't break until the other loop is completed or the other task is completed first. And then a nested loop, which is really confusing, is like a loop inside another loop. So when, let me think. When one loop is being, when one loop is taking place, then if you prompt a certain scenario, another loop will take place depending on what you choose. And the only way to break it is through certain conditions. Examples include Halo. Halo is like, so basically in Halo, when you die, you respawn and you're stuck in a loop because you're going to continue to respawn until a condition is met. So like when the game ends as a amount of kills is over, then the loop is busted. Tetris is another one because they keep giving you blocks until the level is completed or you lose. Legend of Zelda, that I'm sure people aren't too familiar with that one, so I'll skip that one. And then Groundhog Day, which isn't a game, but I mean for people who aren't gamers, I guess that's the easiest example where Bill Murray is kind of stuck in a loop over and over until he finally comes with some epiphany and then he can break the loop. And then breaking the loop just lets you continue forward in the game. So variables are the ones that store information. This can be numerical, string, fixed, or changing. values that alter dependent upon the condition. So if a variable is at 1, this event occurs. If a variable is at 2, this event occurs, and so on and so forth. I mean, or I guess that's more for loop variables, because loop variables are just numbers, whereas they'll change based on a certain threshold. And then some examples of this are Pong. Pong just has the number go up as a person scores. So that's probably the most basic example. And then Sonic the Hedgehog collects a certain amount of rings, but differently than Pong, the rings can go down and you can go back down to 0, and then the variable can go up again. Although those numbers really don't have a condition set, they just go up or down. And then Harvest Moon, Stardew Valley, which is just like a farming game, is where you befriend people and then you can gain hearts, and those can also go up or down. And once a certain amount of hearts is reached, then a condition could take place to the point where someone can get married or, you know, get certain gifts from NPCs and whatnot. The last one is a conditional branch. This is a if-else statement. So if something is set to true, these events will occur. False, the other events will occur. These are used a lot, especially in pseudocode, because this determines whether one thing is going to happen or not. They change the outcome dependent upon the choice conditions of variables, sequences, and so on. They're definitely the most complex. A lot of alterations when making a video game. Some examples include Call of Duty with the health system. So if it's 0, then you die. But otherwise, then you're still alive and you can keep playing. So that's like an if-then or if-then statement. Minecraft, based on a certain biome you enter, then the weather might change or certain enemies will appear. And then Simon Says, which is not really, it's kind of a game, not a video game though. But Simon Says is a very basic example. If you press the right button, the game continues. Then otherwise, you have to start all over. And I'm going to try to do a quick demonstration. So I don't know. Do I need to stop sharing and then reshare, or can I just switch tabs? Can you see this tab or no?
You need to switch windows. Yeah.
Okay, so stop sharing and then, okay. One second.
You can use window, make sure everything's on the same screen, and then you can just switch tabs.
Oh, I just stopped sharing and resharing.
It's fine. Yeah.
Oh, okay. You got
it. I see it.
All right. I'm going to do, so I'm using RPG Maker. RPG is the easiest thing for me to understand when it comes to pseudocode, because it gives you a great demonstration of how it all works. I'll make this quick. I'll start with the code. Or I'll start how the functions work, and then I'll show how the code is. So you go in. I don't know if you'll be able to hear the sound effects, but so basically this is the format of a switch. You talk to this person, they say talk to the rock. You talk to the rock, made a sound effect. And it says you did it, and then you get to go forward. So it's basically a linear point. So once you do this, then you can move to the next step. And then as this person says, would you like to progress? This is the form of a loop, or if I say no, then I'm stuck in this loop. And then to break the loop, you say yes, and then they disappear. And these are really basic examples. Obviously, they get more creative when you play a more larger video game, but I'm just giving basic examples. And then this guy says, give me 3 C's. I pick up 1, but he wants 3. So it's a condition. This one's got a condition to it. So I need all 3. And then this lets you progress forward. And then this one is more of an if-then statement. So if I have 5 coins, I can go through, but if I don't, then I'm stuck here. So this one shows 2, and then it will show me whether I have 5 or not. I don't, I only have 2. So I have to collect all the coins, and then I can progress. And then I win. Oh, here's how it kind of works, is this person is set, has a linear statement, Whereas she says talk to the rock, and then she says you can go through, and then it turns a switch on. And then once that switch is on, they disappear and let you go forward because the rock has a switch. And that's how the pseudocode works for that. This person has a loop statement, says where would you like to progress? If you say yes, it breaks the loop. But if you say no, then it's going to repeat above in the same loop. So you have to redo the loop again until you can break it. And then for the variable, he says, give me 3 seeds. And then you check once you have 3 or above, then he disappears. And then each seed gives +1 to the variable. So with each one, then he'll let you pass through. And then last, for the if-then statement, which is done in a conditional branch or a case statement, he says, if you have 5 coins, you can go through. So if you do, then he breaks. But else, your coins are shown. Or else, this text shows your coins, and then it goes back to nothing. So once you collect all the coins, 3 + 2, then he disappears. And then basically, you win the game. These are very basic examples. Obviously, I didn't want to go too in-depth. Because the first time I saw it, I was very scared on what was going on. But, yeah, that's my presentation.
When you play test it, does it open another window? Because I don't think we saw how it ran.
Oh, you didn't? Oh, no. Yeah, yes. I was in the whole presentation then. That's not good.
I mean, we see this RPG Maker screen with everything sitting on the screen. Yeah, I was hoping... But we don't see the playtest.
Okay.
That's why I think if you share your window, anything that pops up in the window will show.
Okay, but I can show
if
that.
Share a screen.
Okay, 1 second. Yeah, because I wanted to show how that works. So share when you said window.
Screen 1 or screen 2 or something, and everything's on that same screen, we will see what you change on that screen.
I had it set to window, but
yeah, you should choose a screen.
Oh, entire screen. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
There we go.
Okay, sorry, that's embarrassing.
No, that's cool. Okay.
Yeah, I wanted to show how this works. So basically, you go talk to the rock, and then it makes a sound effect to the point, and then she says you did it, and then you can go through to the next step, which is a linear type scenario with the switches, as I explained earlier with the Gears of War and Pokemon. And then this one says, would you like to progress? And if you say no, you're stuck in a loop until the text is busted, broken. And once you say yes, you can go through. And then as for this one, it says 3 seeds. If I say this picks up 1 seed, but I need 3 seeds to get through. So I can't get through until I grab all 3 seeds. And then that's a variable to the point where if I have 3 seeds, then I can progress to the next step. And then this one is the if-then statement. He's giving me 5 coins, and he shows 0 coins. But if I pick up 2 coins, that's still not enough to progress, so he still won't let me through. But if I collect 3 more coins, then I'm able to progress. And that breaks the if-then statement. If this happens, then I can go through, but otherwise I would have had to stay back. And then basically, I win. So that's a very basic example of it, as I said already, but because it kind of gets very confusing the more in-depth you get with it. Although that's just a show through RPGs. I'm sure many other video games can explain it a lot better. So yeah, that's all I have. Does anybody have any questions?
That makes sense now.
Okay, that must have been very confusing to see me doing nothing for 5 minutes.
I know, I was like, wait a minute, is he showing the screen? No, but that's great, that's good to know.
Yeah, it's
another learning process. Yeah.
Yeah, especially, it's more of a hobby than anything when it comes to trying to make video games, but it's definitely something to understand, because once you understand pseudocode, it makes you understand a lot of the other code as well.
Yeah.
Well, some of them are similar. A lot have different aspects to it as well.
Well, once you know the pseudocode, you can just write code in whatever language you want to write it in. Or yeah.
Huh.
Because that's the logic flow.
See, I just thought pseudocode was fake code.
I mean, coders use it to, you know, help. They write it out first before typing out the code, because then it explains it a little better for them. But no, many people, like in some programs, you can just use comments or something.
Yeah.
Where it tells you what this is doing. But others, like I like to write it out with pseudocode before I do any code, which I, again, do very little coding. But I mean, with what I can do, it's usually just Ruby, which is more of gaming than anything. I need to learn core ones like Python and C# and Java.
Right. Well, that was cool. Yeah. See, you taught me something.
Well, if you know Ruby on Rails, Python should be easy.
Yeah. I know there was the first class we had with the intern. Jordan was explaining the Mike guy on YouTube. He's got a lot of coding videos you can watch, which, you know, I've watched a couple of his, but they're like 4 hours long and they take a while to get through, but they're very insightful. So I might take a few more looks at or his coding one if I want to develop some basics.
Yeah. Awesome. Very cool. Great job. You even got to watch some gaming. Very good. Okay, and now we have 10. It's all yours.
Hello. Eric PHP. Okay, can you see my screen and hear me?
Yes.
Awesome. My name is Tan Tran, and my masterclass presentation is on mining cryptocurrency, also known as digital gold. A little disclaimer, I am not for or against mining cryptocurrency. I am neutral and just an observer on how it affects our world. Cryptocurrency is volatile. It is not backed by a physical commodity. It is not owned or governed by any entity. Mining cryptocurrency is very controversial. Please do not spend what you cannot afford on crypto. Many life savings has been drained due to the digital gold. Here's a brief history of cryptocurrency. Okay. The concept of cryptocurrency first emerged in 1983 through the work of American cryptographer David Chaum. He presented a conference paper outlining a form of anonymous cryptographic electronic money. The idea was to create a digital currency that could be exchanged between individuals or machines without the need for centralized entities like banks. In 1988, Nick Szabo developed a precursor to Bitcoin called BitGold. It required participants to dedicate their computing power to solving cryptographic puzzles, and in return, those who successfully solved the puzzles were rewarded with BitGold currency. However, BitGold faced a significant challenge known as the double spending problem. This problem arose because digital data could be easily copied and pasted without the control of a central authority. So anyone could just hack their way in and create their own currency. So BitGold didn't really work out well, or on paper at least. 2 decades later, however, when the financial crisis hit in 2008, it brought to light the need for an alternative to the traditional banking system. It created an opportunity for the world's first cryptocurrency to take center stage. In October of that year, an individual or group operating under the pseudonym of Satoshi Nakamoto published a white paper titled Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. The white paper introduced a new type of currency, Bitcoin, and it also addressed the double spending problem by leveraging blockchain technology. This technology utilized a digital ledger that recorded all transactions using immutable data structures. By doing so, it ensured the integrity and transparency of all transactions, a complete history that that everybody can see. Bitcoin went live in January 2009, with the first blocks being mined by Satoshi Nakamoto. This marked the beginning of a new era in decentralized digital currency. Bitcoin laid the foundation for subsequent cryptocurrencies and opened up possibilities for peer-to-peer electronic transactions, independent of traditional financial institutions. The emergence of cryptocurrency and the underlying blockchain technology has sparked a wave of innovation and transformative potential in various industries. They have provided individuals with greater control over their financial transactions and challenged the existing centralized systems. As the cryptocurrency ecosystem continues to evolve, new opportunities and challenges arise. Nevertheless, the revolutionary impact of cryptocurrencies spearheaded by Bitcoin has forever changed the way we perceive and engage in money in the digital age. On to mining Bitcoin. Mining Bitcoin involves several steps to ensure the validity of transactions and add them to the blockchain. The first step is transaction verification, where Bitcoin transfers between wallets are checked for their authenticity. This involves confirming that the sender has sufficient funds and that the transaction adheres to the rules of the Bitcoin protocol. Verified transactions are then grouped into blocks. Miners compete to solve a complex mathematical puzzle called a proof of work algorithm. This algorithm requires miners to perform numerous calculations to find a specific solution, known as a cryptographic hash. That meets certain criteria. It is important to note that mining is computationally intensive and demands significant computational power and is one of the major controversies surrounding cryptocurrency, at least in its beginning days. When a miner finds the solution, it is verified by other miners, and if the majority of miners agree that the solution is correct, it becomes a permanent part of the blockchain, which cannot be altered, removed, or deleted. Miners who participate in solving the puzzle or verifying solutions are rewarded with newly minted Bitcoin based on their computational work. This serves as an incentive for miners to contribute their computational work and acts somewhat like a traditional banking system where they verify transactions and receive payment for doing so. Bitcoin has a limited supply, and each time more Bitcoin is minted, the mining process becomes more challenging. The difficulty of the puzzle is designed to require substantial computational power and time to solve. This computational expense acts as a deterrent against malicious attacks on the network. The competitive nature of mining ensures that no single entity can gain control over the creation of new blocks or the transaction verification process. It maintains the decentralized nature of Bitcoin and prevents any individual or group from monopolizing the network. Overall, mining Bitcoin involves verifying transactions, grouping them into blocks, solving complex puzzles, and receiving rewards in the form of newly minted Bitcoin. This process secures the network, maintains the integrity of the blockchain, and facilitates the decentralized nature of the cryptocurrency. The mathematical puzzle is far too complex to explain in a 15-minute presentation, so I will present the fingerprint analogy. Imagine you had to find the height, weight, and overall look of a person giving a fingerprint sample. The only way to find a solution is to compare the fingerprint sample with every person on Earth until you find a match. Now imagine you are also in a competition and all the other miners are doing the same thing. Whoever finds it first wins and gets the reward of newly minted Bitcoin. Basically, your computational power is used to randomly compare hashes to find the matching solution. It's a lot of guessing. The steps to mining Bitcoin. Mining Bitcoin or other cryptocurrency is not as easy as one thinks, but it's not rocket science either. And if you have enough desire, you can definitely mine some digital gold, although I do not recommend it these days. The first step is to purchase some mining hardware. Some popular ones are called Antminers. They're used to mine Bitcoin, which is an all-in-one setup that only requires you to plug in some electricity and you point it at a mining pool. You can they offer their own software. As long as they have their Bitcoin wallet, the mining pool's address, the machine will automatically solve those complex computational hash puzzles, and you will be rewarded. And you can watch the digital gold flow straight to your wallet. The other type of hardware is GPUs, graphic processing unit, the ones used for playing video games these days. The second step is getting a Bitcoin wallet so you can store your gold. Then you just have to download and install some mining software, join a mining pool, and start mining. They're pretty much both the same, except the Antminers, the all-in-one setup, they provide you the software and is an all-in-one, while if you're using the GPU version and you have a desktop, then you have to do all of the configurations yourself. Okay, so a new way of mining crypto. In recent years, there have been several ways to mine cryptocurrency, and I will elaborate on one of them, the proof of stake consensus. So before, when we were talking about mining with the solving complex puzzle, that is called a proof of work consensus, which is your computer does the work, and that is the proof. Ethereum, currently the second largest cryptocurrency, initially adopted a proof of work consensus mechanism, similar to Bitcoin. However, in response to concerns about the excessive energy consumption associated with proof of work, Ethereum decided to transition to proof of stake since last year. The transition to proof of stake was prompted by the outcry over the substantial amount of energy required to secure the Ethereum blockchain using proof of work. Unlike proof of work, proof of stake no longer relies on miners solving complex puzzles or requiring expensive hardware. Instead, proof of stake miners are required to stake their own cryptocurrency on the network, which means they must lock up their assets and cannot utilize them during the staking period. When we say assets are staked, it means that the digital currency remains on the network untouched and unable to be withdrawn for a specific duration. By staking their assets, miners demonstrate their commitment to the network security and participate in the consensus process. In proof of stake, the competition among miners to verify transactions or create new blocks no longer exists. In the new system, miners are scored based on the number of coins they have staked and the length of time they have had them staked. The miner with the highest at stake has a greater chance to be chosen to validate a transaction and receive a reward. This selection process ensures a fair and secure distribution of mining responsibilities within the network. The transition from proof of work to proof of stake in Ethereum aims to address the energy efficiency concerns associated with traditional mining by eliminating the need for resource intensive calculations and replacing them with staking. Ethereum reduces its carbon footprint by 99% and becomes more environmentally friendly. Furthermore, the proof of stake mechanism in Ethereum offers benefits such as increased scalability and security. It allows for a higher number of transactions to be processed per second and mitigates the risk of a 51% attack, which is where a single entity gains majority control over the network. The transition to proof of stake represents an important milestone for Ethereum and the broader cryptocurrency ecosystem. It showcases the industry's commitment to sustainability and innovation. exploring alternative consensus mechanisms beyond traditional mining. The future of crypto mining. Proof of work is still here, still being used by Bitcoin, but it may be dead in the future because the amount of newly minted Bitcoin is coming to, it will end soon. There's a limit, and there can only be, it can only last for so long. Proof of stake is the most recent alternative used by Ethereum and adopted by other, by newer cryptocurrencies these days. There's also other variations, such as proof of identity, that is being researched. There's also proof of network, where routers would verify data and communicate with other routers to verify a transaction on the network as well. And we don't know, but there may be even other forms of proofs may be invented in the future as well. However, what we do know is mining cryptocurrency will always be here because it's simply a verification method and will continuously evolve. Cryptocurrency does not seem like a phase, and it looks like it's here to stay. That is all for my presentation. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you have any questions or comments,
so that's pretty amazing. And I've always had a question about cryptocurrency. I still don't understand it.
So my question is, what do you think about when quantum computing comes in and the ability to run computations so much greater? Is that going to affect this?
For the mining process, for solving mathematical puzzle, it absolutely will affect this. However, that depends on the energy efficiency of quantum computers, because it has always come down to an energy problem. Even the GPUs today, people that live in areas that has cheaper electricity has always been winning and making more profit than other areas. And usually Bitcoin mining today are all stolen electricity. So you can see sometimes from the news that some government from somewhere just destroyed or raided a Bitcoin mining farm because they were stealing electricity just for profit, because it's so hard to compete.
Oh, I just wanted to comment because your analogy, the fingerprint analogy, just read a paper not that long ago that they've solved that, by the way, because that's a polygenic trait. There's multiple genes that affect that, and they've actually dissected all those genes now. So that analogy may no longer be useful.
Wow.
I know, because I used to take an advanced genetics class where we actually looked at fingerprints, and there is a genetic inheritance to it. And you can actually look at that in the whorls and the arches.
I'm not sure if they'll do that for, I'm pretty sure they'll figure out a way for mining, but mining in the solving mathematical puzzle sense might be dead at that point regardless.
Yeah, good. Well, the next thing to do would be, if you can't do the brute force, you just figure out what the algorithm is for deciding what the problem is.
Yeah, I believe Bitcoin is using the SHA-256 algorithm at the moment, and some others might be using the 126, I believe, or 128, or something like that.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll keep hacking at it until I get rich.
Me too. That's what I'm wondering. I'm like, how is it possible to be able to use something that's not even there? It's like an idea that somebody came up, but it's not, again, it's not physical. And
hey, that's what fiat currency is.
Well, it's like, you know, we're all playing Monopoly.
And our government is trying to go digital currency as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
In time.
So question is, what's the most exciting digital currency in your opinion? It seems like Bitcoin is kind of phasing out a little bit. It has some older older structures to it. Is Ethereum kind of the most exciting one, or are there other ones that are maybe a little bit more cutting edge?
Dogecoin.
Unfortunately, Bitcoin still remains my number one for one reason. That is, there's just more countries that has adopted it, and you can pay for a lot more things online and in certain countries to purchase stuff. Once another cryptocurrency has surpassed that, or if other retailers, e-commerce, or anything, any seller that is willing to accept the new currency or another type or one that's more common, then that would be the most exciting one. Unfortunately, right now is still Bitcoin, because I guess the world hasn't been really been updating with cryptocurrency like that. So we'll just have to wait and see. So far, Bitcoin and Ethereum is the most popular.
I know it's something that a lot of different governments have wanted. I think, doesn't China have their own coin? I know Jamaica has their own. I think it's called Pineapple that it's now using. I know it's funny, but I think it, and then there's one for China or South Korea that's using one, because they're all going to something more like Bitcoin instead of using dollars and yens and all that. They're deciding to do the coin.
Yeah. And the other problem is, I just wanted to mention that regulation wise is preventing any coin from being the most exciting. For example, in New York, if I'm a resident of New York, which I am, I can only purchase Bitcoin or Ethereum or like a set of 5 coins out of thousands that are out there. And that is because I have regulations over here. And my mayor over here, the new mayor, announced it something like a New York coin or something, and he said that his first 3 paychecks was going to be paid in those coins. So it's getting really out of hand.
Yeah, have fun, mayor.
Yeah.
It's so like everyone's coming up with their own gimmick, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So is that going to phase out our dollars and cents?
Well, the government is trying to phase out our dollar and cents by coming up with their own cryptocurrency, digital currency. We don't know when that's going to happen or if that will even pass, but is in the talks and is in the works.
And the problem with that is the same thing that happened in India when they turned around and they said one day they woke up, or no, it was one day, 8 p.m. at night, they suddenly decided they were no longer using dollar bills. They were using the cryptocurrency, and it totally changed the economics and the way that everything worked. So you had a huge portion that became poor and a small portion that were rich now because of the coin that they were using. So we have to watch how that can change things. Now we have our levels of what that is, you know, and you can change that with the work that you do, you know, gain the skills and you can get a better job and go up the ladder. Later on, it's going to be who can get the coin. It's not even going to be determined by, you know, earning it through something.
So no lottery.
No lottery. on one hand, it's pretty exciting that we're entering a different, it's like a shift of how we trade. And on the other hand, it's also scary because what we already have might be obsolete.
Yeah. So. Store your bills. Store your dollar bills, because those are going to be trade worthy later for Bitcoin.
So how are you going to trade with Bitcoin if you pull out your money? How are they going to get the?
Well, dollar bills are going to be changed. So rare, people are going to pay you Bitcoin for something that's rare, right? Just like if you were to find the 1943, is it steel penny or it's a no, it's a. It's a 1943 steel penny, I think.
Yeah.
That is very rare. It's worth $1 million or something like that.
What?
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, so gosh. I got my million now.
Pillowcase with all my money.
Yeah. So find that 1943. There's only like 3 left out there. I don't know.
Wow.
But you got to, and you know, and it's going to be the same thing later on. It's, yeah. So.
Yeah. I know.
I think that was that was minted from a certain mint and had a defect. There's only three.
Yes.
Mine's not that. It's more of the run of the mill still penny.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah, I don't know if it was.
Because I have all of them.
Because at that time they changed it to copper, or they changed it to. They only have so many steel because the steel was being used during World War II.
Yes.
So if it's a copper coin, it's a regular penny. But I think if it's a steel one, it just accidentally was made. So, and that's worth a ton because there was only so many made.
I haven't seen those.
Nope.
Oh, well.
Well, if you do,
circulation.
You're a millionaire.
No wonder I'm poor.
Yeah. That's why I don't throw pennies away. It's probably in a garbage dump somewhere.
The other thing that I can't wrap my head around is because cryptocurrency always has a finite amount that when they start the white paper on any cryptocurrency, some are unlimited, but Bitcoin and Ethereum, the two most popular, are finite. There's only like 2 billion produced it. And if it's in your wallet or your hard drive, basically, and if you lost it, well, you can't get that back.
Yeah, that's now, what I heard.
Yeah, but for cash, fiat, or government digital currency, there's an unlimited amount. They could just produce it at any time. So there will be inflation would be worse if that happened.
And that's what happened in India. Yeah.
Because it's limited, we're going to have the same reason why we went off of the gold standard.
Exactly. It's not backed by anything. Right. It's not backed by anything. So who knows?
Because gold was limiting and people were stockpiling it in other nations.
Yeah.
Yep.
Maybe we need a different country.
We need to make our own country. Go back to old bills.
The country of Charlene. Hey.
There you go.
Or we can just use leaves as currency.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There's plenty of leaves, though.
Oh, yeah. And so long, and thanks for all the fish.
Exactly. Well, that was excellent. Thank you so much. I always try to learn about cryptocurrency, but it's still such a confusing idea to me.
Yeah. It makes my head hurt.
It's that tangibility. I just don't feel right about not having something tangible. Although, you know, I use my card for everything. I don't use cash anymore. So I can't say much, but at least I can look in the bank and see what I got.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can earn it at least, right?
So far.
Thank you so much. Go ahead. Yeah, so far. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Tan. And thank you, everybody else, all our other presenters. Excellent, excellent jobs. I'm good so night. Proud of what you came up with.
Awesome.
Very good.
Yes. Yeah. Good night, everybody. Thank you. We got 10:35. We're late, but that's okay.
This is
great. We spend the nights together. You know, I mean, what else are we going to do? Class, grade. We got all kinds of things. Have a great night, everybody.
Good night.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Good night, all.